Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Telltale Heart, a cardiovascular digest for pharmacists. And I know we're a little bit late on this episode, and there was a gap between my last episode, which was the dyslipidemia guidelines, and this one. To give some explanation, I went to the ACC, the American College of Cardiology meeting. That was at the end of March, the very last weekend of March. And between then, I ended up going to Singapore for 2 weeks to help their national health ministry do some work in terms of pharmacy training and cardiovascular work in terms of their community. And because of that, and because of the quick turnaround time with ACC, I was not able to record an episode. So we had a gap. So I apologize for that. But we're back in force. And I know it has been a few weeks since ACC. However, I think it's still worth time to debrief on some of the trials and maybe like a good, you know, sauce. It's marinated a little bit with our guest today and other folks as well. And we can maybe have a better conversation that people have had a chance to really think about it from this standpoint. Before we jump into the conversation, I always want to hear from people. If you want to like or subscribe or give feedback or commentary, that would be amazing. We would love that type of information. It helps us drive or change content. And so just please give us feedback, email or call. But we do have some great episodes coming up. I know I've mentioned some things we've been trying to plan. They're still underway, but we're trying to get some other things coordinated. So more to come. However, without further ado, I'm going to jump into the episode, and we have Kyle Fisher back. Now, he's like one of the few guests that has come back or has joined me again, and I'm excited for you to be here. Now, this time, Kyle's doing it a little different. The last time before AHA, he helped me go through what things he thought were going to be great, and then we had a different group debrief, but here he is going to actually do the debriefing of things for the trial, so he gets to play a different role. And so, Kyle, just so, you know, if people can't remember who you are and where you're from and what you do, will you kind of give yourself an introduction?
Yeah, of course. And Craig, thanks for having me again. I'm excited to be here and talk about these trials with you. So like Craig said, my name's Kyle Fisher. I'm born and raised in Texas. I'm a cardiology clinical pharmacy specialist, primarily working in inpatient general cardiology right now at Ascension Seton Medical Center Austin at Dell Medical School in Austin, Texas. And it's been about 3 years since I completed my PGY2 at Duke University. And it's been a good start to my early career. And I'm excited to be here and talk about the trials that came out on ACC.
Perfect. Now, I did, you know, let Kyle actually pick his trials this time. If you recall, our AHA episode, which had a game where it was random and he really didn't know what he was going to get into. So he actually had a little bit more say in this. But the good news is I think there were a lot of good trials at ACC. We clearly not able to get to talk to all of them. A lot of these are pharmacotherapy driven. There actually was some really interesting non-pharmacotherapy trials, but trials that were very important in terms of still management from cardiovascular disease. For example, there was a food as medicine trial and so forth. And we'll probably put some linkage to those or can most certainly maybe talk about them later. But there was definitely some great content that was not specifically, pharmacy-based, but just like, for example, there was the THRIVE trial that looked at culturally tailored food as medicine, and it lowered blood pressure in Black and Hispanic adults. And so they had a 24-week participant process where they helped tailored vegetable nuts and gave them this food and rich diet, and it was very successful. And it fits along lines with a lot of our dietary guidelines. But that's just an example of some of the other great science that was there. But I think we, being pharmacists, are trying to stick with some of the pharmacotherapy-based ones. So we'll do that today. So, Kyle, I think the first study that you told me that you were going to talk about, and I think it's a very valid one, and I think a lot of people were really watching this one amongst the other ones, is the SPRINT-HF trial. And so, Kyle, do you want to give the audience a little bit of favor and fill for this trial? Why was this trial being done? And I think we've talked a little bit about this context with other agents on this podcast, but it's a good review. So tell us about this trial, Kyle.
Yeah, so SPRINT-HF, very interesting trial looking at spironolactone in our HFpEF population. And we have, as most of you guys know, the spironolactone data that was published a while ago from TopCat. And that's kind of one of our strongest, if you want to use that word, for these MRIs in that patient population. So they set out, this was a non-industry sponsored study, publicly funded. It was done in 56 centers in Europe from 2018 to 2024, double-blind randomized trial that had about 730 patients with symptomatic HFpEF or HFmrEF to either spironolactone or placebo. Their primary endpoint was CV death or total first and recurrent heart failure hospitalizations. Now, this trial is not fully available yet, but from what was presented at ACC, we have their median age was around like 78 years old. Half of the study population were women, and most, about 80% of the patients in that study were HFpEF. Now, again, since this trial is not fully available, I don't have a whole list of baseline characteristics available to go deep into that. But looking at their primary endpoint, which again was the CV death or total heart failure hospitalizations, so their relative risk was 1.18 and it was not statistically significant. And this was numerically trending in the wrong direction, not in favor of spironolactone. The problem with this trial, or the real eye-opening thing about this trial that got published, was the safety signal that was shown here. So hypotension, the relative risk here was 2.26 for spironolactone. Hyperkalemia relative risk was about 3.49, and the renal events relative risk was about 1.75. And when you're looking at these patients in HFpEF and HFmrEF, only about 5.2% were on background ARNI, and about 17% were on background SGLT2 inhibitors. So this is a very concerning safety signal that we're seeing from this study. Now, one neat thing that the SPIRITH-HF investigators did was they conducted a meta-analysis that pulled the SPIRITH-HF data from, as well as the TopCat participants from the Americas data. And when they did this meta-analysis, they still found that spironolactone had no significant effect on outcomes with that combined data set. So that kind of made everyone's eyes prop up a little bit in at ACC, especially on when they released that meta-analysis or presented that meta-analysis. But with that being said, there is some critical gaps within this SPIRITH-HF trial. So the investigator said that COVID-19 devastated this trial. That being said, though, they only enrolled 50% of the planned patients and captured less than 75% of assumed events. There was substantial drug withdrawal during the follow-up, and that could possibly be due to the adverse events that were reported. This was an underpowered trial, and there were numerically higher event rates with spironolactone after treatment withdrawal, which raises a rebound hypothesis. Now, one thing that there was a lot of chatter about as well, now, this trial does come with some flaws, but the counterpart over here, FINE-ARCH-HF, enrolled a similar population with finerenone, and finerenone did show benefit. So the question is whether the older, less selective MRA being spironolactone behaves differently, or whether tolerability drove the outcome here still remains unresolved. So this was a very eye-opening trial, and I am still trying to figure out what to do with spironolactone in my HFpEF patients after this trial, because before this trial, we had TopCat, and really we push our SGLT2 inhibitors for our HFpEF patients, and then you have your MRA being like spironolactone. Now, after this trial, I'm kind of left on maybe not as convinced as spironolactone, and that's my professional opinion, but this trial was a very interesting results, and hopefully we'll get the full release here soon.
Yeah, so I think everyone is very excited about this data because, to your point, we don't, it's not that we don't know that there is a role for MRAs in HFpEF, HFmrEF. I think there clearly is something there. For sure, we have data from FINE-ARCH that suggests finerenone does play a benefit in this population, and that's so far been the cleanest study of, if you will,
Agreed.
of the ones that we have, in terms of what that looks like. Obviously Top Cat has had its own critiques and problems, and I think we've talked about this in a variety of different settings on the on this podcast. I think because of that, people really wanted some clarity and some answers. And unfortunately, due to all the things you outlined, we did not get a trial that was clean again. And it brought, definitely didn't answer the question. Now it brought quote more questions because I think the thing that sticks to me is of the people that stayed in the study, a lot of people discontinued the drug, as you alluded to. And so that's a little concerning, because of potentially the adverse events and those pieces. And I think to your point, when we get the better publication, we'll understand what that might have looked like. Was it self-discontinuation? Did the clinician discontinue the therapy? What are the reasons for that? But I think we definitely don't have a set of answers that tells us this. To your point, when you pull it together with Top Cat Americas, it appears that there is that benefit that is there. I know there is another trial going on that's a Spirit, also called Spirit, with an extra R in it. It's a registry-based study. Maybe that will help. I'm not sure. I just don't think we're realistically going to get an answer from this standpoint. If you are going to be, and I don't know how your team is practicing, Kyle, and on your domain, there's clearly obviously two camps. The people that are like, well, spironolactone can be used in this population, it's very cost effective. And then there's the camp of people that are like, well, the only trial that we've clearly have clear data on shows, is finerenone. I will think of it personally when I get down to it. And obviously, if I can remove the cost or get it to be a cost effective and the patient's willing to accept it, and that's a little bit of a patient shared decision conversation, I most certainly could see putting them on finerenone because it has the cleaner safety profile. I mean, to me, that's the clearest. You have a clear difference from that standpoint. There was pretty decent tolerability of finerenone in its study that, patients were able to maintain. Of course, we'll have additional finerenone data coming out as well between REDEFINE as it's enrolling, CONFIRMATION is their other study that'll be in. So I think we'll have additional data. But I think at this time, to me, it's kind of that type of conversation. I don't know how are you approaching this, especially after this trial, Kyle? How are you approaching the population?
Yeah, and to your point, those two camps are, I have both those camps in
With
my
your teams,
hospital.
yeah, right.
Yeah, with my team. So it is just hard, kind of like if we think there is a signal of benefit for the MRAs, and depending what camp I'm talking to, really, if that's how it kind of boils down to. I agree with you. If, let's say, if costs were equal between finerenone and spironolactone, I would 100% be leaning more towards using finerenone in this patient population. But due to the cost right now, and also at our hospital, we do not have finerenone on formulary at the moment. So really our only option at this point is to do spironolactone. But we're really weighing risk versus benefits. Like, is this a patient that follows up regularly, is on top of taking their meds and all that stuff, so that we can, because I think the safety signal is loud. And from this trial, and it's been 3-ish weeks since ACC, I went back and pulled some data in patients that had an EF greater than 40%, and looking just
Like your
at,
own personal data?
yeah, own personal
Yeah.
data, and just looking at discontinuation rates. And from our personal data, the MRAs has the highest discontinuation rates at our from our patient population as well. Now, I don't have the exact reasoning. Is it because of just hypertension, I mean hypotension, renal events, hyperkalemia? I don't know that just yet. I'm still working through some of that data that I'm pulling. But it was interesting to see that the highest discontinuation rate was spironolactone. So we're really trying to make it a patient-centered decision. And if we feel that this is inappropriate from a safety standpoint, that this patient can tolerate and follow up on a regular basis with this MRI. That's how we're starting to use this now. And we are currently in the works of trying to get finerenone on formulary. And once that happens, we'll see maybe if there's a shift in using finerenone, but it's also based on the cost as
Are you
well.
guys using it at transitions of care or, in your outpatient setting? Are you aware?
We, from what I've heard, like, I don't even think more than 10 patients have tried it. A lot of it's just we've ran into a lot of cost issues at the moment, trying to get it. So I think that's just one of the big rate limiting steps. But our
Sure.
cardiologists here in our group are pretty excited about the opportunity to at least attempt to get this on formulary and see what we can do once it is on formulary.
Yeah, no, I think it, yeah, here's what I will say, and I don't suspect we're going to get an answer to this question
I
about
agree.
spironolactone, an answer that everyone is going to be thrilled with. Now, as we get all this data and we pull it all together, maybe we will have a situation where people are a little bit maybe feel better about it or not. I don't know. It is interesting to see what people are going to do with this. I know they're getting ready to gear up and start the guideline writing process for heart failure. It'll be interesting to see how they end up positioning finerenone, if they'll position it together or separate from that standpoint. I think, of course, we'll hopefully have more data maybe by then. We'll have to see how that goes from that standpoint. But yeah, so it just the interesting thing was just, clearly the discontinue rates are very fascinating to me in this study that, a lot of people really didn't. And shockingly, the hypotension was a lot. Like, I mean, you expected the hypokalemia, which I mean, not, I mean, let me rephrase that. Shocking, but not shocking, because we know spironolactone has the ability to do that and manage hypertension, and these patients may have that, but it was just wasn't the signal I was thinking was going to be the adverse event that came out of this.
Agreed.
But it, again, of course, you have limited number. But I just think it definitely doesn't answer the question. It's just inconclusive. So, yeah. So, anyways, anything else you wanted to add to this from that standpoint?
No, I think we covered the
Yeah.
gist of it.
Yeah, well, actually, I do want to add one other thing, because, I will tell you the other group that I kind of consider this is, given that HFpEF often overlaps in a cardiokidney metabolic domain, right? And because we do have data now, of course, finerenone has been approved for type 2 diabetes or patients with diabetic kidney disease. I think I saw their top line results for their chronic kidney disease appear very promising.
It's on that, yep.
And so, and that paper hasn't been released, so we don't know the details of it, but I think there is clearly something to be said for those patients that are in those overlapping bubbles as well, that maybe there's some guidance to move in that direction, because spironolactone also has questionable data when it comes to kidney disease and dysfunction at this time
Agreed.
as well. And so I think, there may, it does kind of suggest there may be something to this balanced kidney heart tissue perfusion with finerenone, and there are some maybe differences to how the MR receptor is. And then, of course, in the future, we'll also have ASIs that may be competing in this space, so we'll see what that is. So it's going to continue to get kind of messy in this process. And, and then I know there's another company that is looking at a non-steroidal MRA, balrisonrenone, which is AstraZeneca's agent that is underway. So maybe we'll get point of all this conversation is maybe we'll get better guidance as it goes along, but at the current time, this is what we have from that standpoint. But interesting. So
Yes.
the next trial that Kyle put in there, and it actually was the one everyone was really excited about, and I think we had Kristen Campbell talk about this in our prep episode, and this brings Kyle full circle because he trained under Kristen, so he gets to talk about the results and maybe make sure he does justice for it, because Kristen may be listening, and we'll be like, talked about his her past resident and make sure that he does exactly what she trained him to do, right?
Yeah,
So
we'll see if she's listening and I'll get a text from
and
her
give
and
the
say,
critique, you're like,
critiquing my critique of
of the
the
Champion AF trial. So
trial.
because Kristen and I, we talked about that, and she practices an EP, and a lot of people were looking at this. So tell us, she did a great job outlining the Champion AF trial, but kind of remind people what this trial is about, and then we'll kind of talk about the results. So
Of course. Yeah, so Champion AF International double blind RCT had about 3,000 patients, and this was a non-inferiority trial with 3 years of follow-up. So patients enrolled in this study were patients with AFib who were suitable candidates for anticoagulation. And you were excluded if you had any MI, stroke, TIA in the last 30 days before enrollment or a major bleeding event that occurred within the previous 30 days leading up to enrollment. You were randomized in a one-to-one fashion to receive either the device-based left atrial appendage closure, the Watchman Flex, or NOAC. And their primary endpoint was a composite of death from CV causes, stroke, or systemic embolism. Looking at just some of the baseline characteristics from this trial, so average age was about 71 for both groups. Most were white, about 85%. The average CHA2DS2-VASc score for both groups were 3.5. HAS-BLED for both groups averaged about 1.3. And then looking at the types of AFib that these patients had, about 68% of that of the whole population had paroxysmal AFib. And then looking at previous atrial fibrillation ablation, there were low rates from a percentage standpoint, but the most around 15% of the whole population had previous AFib ablation between greater than 3 to less than 12 months before randomization. Now, the results of this trial. So again, the primary endpoint being deaths from cardiovascular cause, stroke, or systemic embolism. The trial met the non-inferiority margin according to the investigators. So 65% or 65 patients in the anticoagulation group experienced the primary endpoint and 81 in the device group. And the hazard ratio for that primary endpoint was 1.20. They broke down the components of the primary efficacy endpoint. I'll read them out to you guys here. So the first one being death from cardiovascular cause, 36 patients in the anticoagulation group, 38 patients in the device group. Stroke, this was probably the most interesting one here. So looking at stroke in the anticoagulation group, 33 patients had it, but 50 patients had it in the device group, and that hazard ratio was 1.46. And then the last component of the primary and FC endpoint was systemic embolism. There's two patients that had that in the anticoagulation group, zero in the device group. Safety met superiority for the device group compared to the anticoagulation group, and this was non-procedure related bleeding. And then the other secondary endpoints looking at other safety procedure related and non-procedure related bleeding combined, that met non-inferiority as well. So one thing to take, I guess, what the investigators concluded from this trial was that the patients that had AFib who were candidates for anticoagulation, the device-based left atrial appendage closure was non-inferior, looking at from the primary efficacy endpoint compared to the NOAC therapy, and was superior to NOAC therapy for non-procedure related bleeding at the 3 year mark. So this is interesting results, and if any of you guys have maybe been on whether it's LinkedIn, Twitter that has cardiovascular medicine, or I'm sorry for calling Twitter X. There's been a lot of talk about this trial over the last at least month or so, especially since the results have came out, and some, I guess, controversies, if you want to use that word, regarding this, and mainly stemming from that increased risk of stroke in that device group where they have 50 patients that had a stroke versus the 33 patients in the anticoagulation group. And I think it goes back to, like, just because something's non-inferior does not mean it is a one size fits all approach. And I think that we just got to be careful when we take this. I think a left
Well,
atrial appendage closure. Oh, go for it, Craig.
no, go ahead. Finish what you're saying. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, since I think left atrial appendage closures can be a solid alternative, but I think it's not a one-size-fits approach.
So I will tell you it, to add to that commentary, I think one thing first and foremost that is interesting that makes this very hard to talk about, and this has come up in some of the critiques is, and this is coming up more and more AFib studies, the event rate was way lower than they predicted, which tells you a lot of things about how we're managing these patients, whether that be through, the use of DOACs, whether that be the use of, different ablation strategies that have come out in the last several years, whether that be GLP-1s have also reduced rates, all the things that have changed the trajectory of how we think about the patients and the strategies of these patients, the rates are simply lower. And so the problem is they predicted, I think, a rate of like 12% to use their non to make their non event rate of 12%, which we weren't even close to that. So then, it really puts a weird context for when you're looking at your non-inferiority margin. And technically, yes, they met it, but it's like, should have it been adjusted or looked different based on what the exact event rate or what that analyses were from that standpoint. And so I think then it to your point, what you're saying is like, well, this is where non-inferiority means, it may not mean that it is no difference, and you have to really think about who you're using and what they're using for. I think the other thing that people had lots of issues with is the procedural rate of bleeding that was not included initially in the primary endpoint, but then when you included it as all, it kind of looked almost balanced. And then to your point about the stroke rate events, they were somewhat elevated. Now, you can say argumentatively that I've seen some people try to analyze and say the event rate each year versus the 3 years are very similar to what we've seen in the DOAC or NOAC trials. But again, the purpose of this study is to say, well, we are better than a DOAC or not better. Sorry, I don't want to say better. That's incorrect. But not inferior to a DOAC, which I guess you could argue to say that, but you're trying to give, in theory, an alternative to patients to direct acting agents. And I think the hope was that this would trial would be like, oh, we're going to just be able to give left atrial appendage to everybody. And I think this is maybe the second trial that has been questionable, maybe third, between, they just had the Closure AF, which was studied right, presented at ACC or AHA last year, but then published right before ACC that was not positive for left atrial appendage. Did that included Watchman and Amulet? This was a primary, Champion's a primary Watchman-based study, Watchman Flex-based study. And then they had, was it Prague that looked at, it was a smaller study, but kind of non-inferiority looking at DOAC, but it was like half dose and those types of things. So, the thing that I take away from this is, and it's kind of what you alluded to, Kyle, and I'd be curious on your teams, have people changed their stance on left atrial appendage? But it definitely is still, in my mind, a shared decision-making approach or process. Now, that being said, there are some maybe opportunities to, we had the option trial where it showed in combining this with patients with pulsed field ablation and doing them at the same time. And again, some questions there about the procedural rate of bleeding included in that. However, in theory, if you're going to have that procedure done and it's amenable to do the left atrial appendage device, you could do it then. And maybe that's probably a good version of that from that standpoint. But I don't think this is like changing the paradigm where we're not going to use direct acting agents anymore or anticoagulants. I think there's still a role for them to be had, but then we'll still be looking at patients who maybe not tolerate them or have adherence issues or some other reason that they're not going to have be on a direct acting agent. I don't think this is going to completely just shift the process. I don't know, have people in your institution, have they made a stance since this trial's come out or doing something different?
We really haven't changed much of what we're doing since this trial. It really didn't influence our group one way or the other. Still, really, here we kind of just reserve these Watchmans for people that can't tolerate anticoagulation from a bleeding standpoint. per se. And yeah, this trial didn't, I think we were all hoping, like you alluded to, Craig, that we would say like, oh, look, this trial supports, or at least it gives us a reasonable alternative. But unfortunately, it did not provide us with those answers.
Yeah, I don't think it got us where we want to be on this. So I put this in the, I don't want to say a disappointing trial. I think it's just you have to really look at this trial in context. I will tell you, it's a good trial to talk through learners about non-inferiority and the changes that occurs with them, especially when you don't enroll. Or your event rate is a lot different from that standpoint, but I definitely think the stroke related con risk is of concern from that standpoint. But the increased risk of stroke. But I think the procedural part is the part that bothers me the most, that they didn't include that.
Fair.
And maybe over time that'll get better. I mean, people have gotten way better at Watchman over time, especially with the newer devices. And I know the company is making some catheters and things to also improve the process, and maybe that won't negate it. But it's the stroke part is a little bit, it gives me a little bit of pause. But I think from my understanding, at a the why we're recording this, the Heart Rhythm Society meeting is going on, and there is supposed to be some additional data coming out for Champion AF. I'm not sure what that will look like. It'll be interesting to see what that additional data may provide. Again, I don't think it's going to change the overall outcome or the process, but it's like, okay, maybe it'll help say these are the people that would be of the best benefit from this. But I think it still speaks to shared decision making as a part of the process.
100%.
All right. Let's transition to the next one. So the next one is smart decision, and this is the theme of the episode. Trials we keep thinking will answer questions that we don't actually answer questions for. And smart decision, Kyle is looking at, I feel like I have this after every meeting now. It's either the two concepts that get presented at every meeting now are shortened antiplatelet therapy or single antiplatelet therapy or beta blockers after MI. And so here's yet another beta blocker after MI study. Smart decision, Kyle. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so smart decision, open label RCT non-inferiority trial that had about 2,500-ish patients. This was primarily done in South Korea. So these patients were in stable condition who had a MI and had been receiving beta blocker therapy for at least 1 year and were event-free from the time of the index MI to screening were candidates for the enrollment. No restrictions on beta blocker type or dose were applied in this trial, and no upper limit was imposed on the interval from the index MI diagnosis to treatment. Big exclusion criteria were ongoing treatment for heart failure, a reduced ejection fraction of less than 40%, and contraindications to beta blocker therapy, as well as AFib. There was two groups, so those that continued the beta blocker and those that discontinued the beta blocker, and the median follow-up was about 3.1 years. Looking at the primary endpoint, so that was a composite of death from any cause, recurrent MI, or hospitalization for heart failure. Baseline characteristics were pretty similar between both groups. So, and as a population as a whole, about 57% of them were STEMI patients, 43% were NSTEMI. The median LVEF for both groups was 59%. And then looking at the beta blockers received in this trial, so around 47.5% for both groups were on carvedilol, 32.3% for both groups were around on basoprolol, and then 19.7% were nabivolol, and then they had like this miscellaneous other category, which were less than 1% for the groups. So at the median of 3.1 years of follow-up, the incidence of the primary endpoint was 7.2% in the discontinuation group and 9% in the continuation group. That hazard ratio was 0.80, and the p-value was 0.001, and it met for non-inferiority. Looking at the breakdown from that composite of the primary endpoint, so deaths from any cause, 2.4% in the discontinuation group and 3.4% in the continuation group. MI, 2.3% in the discontinuation group and 2.6% in the continuation group. And then the last component of the composite, which is hospitalization for heart failure, you had a 2.2% event for in the discontinuation group and the 2.1% in the continuation group. They did a sub-analysis looking at different things. One thing that intrigued me, but nothing significant, was the sub-analysis looking at the stratifying EF. So they looked at 40 to 50%, and it showed 7% event rate in the discontinuation group versus 9% in the continuation group. And then they looked at the other subset of EF greater than 50, and that was about 9.9% in the discontinuation group and 7.9% in the continuation group. So overall, just another trial, kind of like Craig alluded to before we started talking on this. Hope that we would get answers. A little bit different, I guess, design compared to some of our other beta blockers after MI trials have been published before. As this trial, like you were on this beta blocker for at least a year, and then you got put into those two groups of either continued it and then discontinued it. But from the conclusion or summary of this trial, like among the patients who did receive beta blocker therapy beyond the first year after MI, the discontinuation of beta blocker therapy was non-inferior to continuation with respect to that composite of death from any cause, recent MI, or hospitalizations for heart failure. So, yeah, just one of these that I feel
Yeah,
like.
so tell me how, describe for you, in your words, how this differs from some of the other data we've had.
I think from here, so we had, now we have like, I guess, more. The other data was looking at discontinuing beta blockers kind of right after your
Right.
MI with normal LVEF. Here, this is looking at discontinuing beta blockers after you've been on it for your 1 year post MI. So I
Right.
guess how you can apply this to like clinical practice, and how I would too, regardless. So like if you have an MI with no other indications for beta blockade, it seems like at least it is relatively safe to stop your beta blocker 1 year after your MI, as long as you have no other indication for beta blockade.
Yeah, I
And
think the difference here, these these are later patients, right? More stable patients to some, maybe to some extent, but I still think it, to me, is it makes me feel better maybe later on stopping them. Now, the other thing is, this is all the population was all what, where were they located? Did you mention
South
that?
Korea,
Yeah,
yeah,
South
South
Korea. So
Korea.
you have to say, is that going to be generalizable to everybody? But but it is the first large randomized trial, if you will, because a lot of the other ones have been random registry kind of based studies, which no, there's nothing wrong with that. They're appropriate design, but I still think, we've had these mixed signals to some extent, but I think what I suspect and what makes me feel better is the further out we are, maybe you can stop them. What was interesting is, I've heard some commentary that some people are still interested in keeping them, maybe for other reasons that they have arrhythmias or some other risk that has them keep their beta blocker on board for whatever reason. But I still think we're still grappling with this question to some extent, especially more in the more acute
Acute
version, like in
phase,
the
yeah.
first year. Is it okay to stop it? And what does that look like? So it goes actually to probably another good old fashioned shared decision making, risk benefit conversation to patients about what to do with their beta blocker and whether they're tolerant. And part of that is going into the conversation around, do you want to take additional meds and polypharmacy and those types of things. Of course, that could be a reason people don't want to take things. So that could be the reason why. But yet another study looking at this question. All right. Kyle, the other one that you alluded to actually parlays into a couple things, and we'll put this in the camp of dyslipidemia, which we just had the guidelines come out, and you can hear my last episode with Joe and Dave about dyslipidemia and all things such. And one trial we talked about that you presented, and then we had the data, was the Avelius data, or the Vercellius data, excuse me, from AHA, but the ACC presented another version of this data, or a specific subset, and they presented patients with diabetes but without ASCVD. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so just to recap the Versilius data that got published in the fall, I believe it was at AHA. So that trial was just about 12,000 patients for high risk for CV events, but no prior MI or strokes, and you had to have qualifying atherosclerosis and or high risk diabetes, and you got randomized to evolucumab versus placebo. They had these dual primary endpoints of 3-point MACE, which consisted of time to coronary heart disease death, MI or ischemic stroke, and then the 4-point MACE, which was everything in the 3-point MACE plus ischemia-driven arterial revascularization. In a high-level summary, evolucumab did meet its primary endpoint in that trial. So at AC6,
And real quick, can I
AC6.
interrupt? We have an entire episode on this with Joe Sassine, if anybody wants to listen to it and go back to our catalog. But anyways, continue. So.
So at ACC, here they did a sub-study, and these were patients with no known significant atherosclerosis. And there was about 30% of the patients from the original study, so about had around 3,600 patients. So in order to be into this sub-study, you had no known significant atherosclerosis, which was defined as no prior arterial revascularization, no known arterial stenosis greater than 50%, and no known coronary artery calcium score, which was greater than 100. And then per the protocol, all had high-risk diabetes, and they defined high-risk diabetes as diabetes for more than 10 years of duration, daily insulin use, or microvascular disease. So looking at the baseline characteristics from this trial, average age was about 65. Of course, everyone had high-risk diabetes, but around 88% of them had hypertension, 28% had were current smokers. Looking at the patients that were on high-intensity statins, that was about 64% of the patient population, and then around 14% were on ezetimibe. Looking at the average lipid values, so average LDL-C in this sub-study was 132, average non-HDL-C was 163, and the average ApoB was 110. So first off, they looked at the effect of evolucumab solely on LDL in this lipid sub-study. So at baseline, like I had mentioned, the average LDL-C was 132, and this was evolucumab versus placebo. At week 48, evolucumab had reduced the LDL-C all the way down to 52. Placebo had reduced it to 111. And at week 96, evolucumab further reduced the LDL-C to 44, and the placebo LDL-C was 105. Looking at the dual primary endpoints, which was the 3-point MACE, so evolucumab had a 5% event rate versus placebo, which was a 7.1% event rate, which was a 31% relative risk reduction, and this was statistically significant. The 4-point MACE, this was also statistically significant with a 31% relative risk reduction, and you saw the evolucumab group had 7.6% event rate, and the placebo group had 10.5% event rate. They also looked at mortality, and they broke it down to cardiovascular deaths as well as all-cause mortality. In the cardiovascular death group, there was 2.6% with evolucumab, 4% in the placebo, and then all-cause mortality, 7.8% in evolucumab group, 10.1% in placebo. So all that to say, when you're like summarizing this thing up, so or this trial up in high-risk primary prevention patients with known significant without known significant atherosclerosis and with diabetes, the addition of evolucumab to baseline lipid-lowering prescription therapy resulted in a median achieved LDL-C of 44, 31% decrease in 3-point and 4-point MACE, 40% decrease in MACE after the first year, 32% decrease in CV death or MI or ischemic stroke, and lower rates of cardiovascular and all-cause death compared to placebo. So very strong data coming from this sub-study population from Vesalius that was originally published in November or released in AHA, and just more ammo for PCSK9 inhibitors and then this really niche patient population being this primary prevention high-risk diabetes patients.
Yeah, I mean, these are high risk patients for sure, and it adds to that layering. Of course, you know, the guidelines didn't get to really address Vesalius because of the way it was published later. So, but it still supports kind of where we're going with lower LDL levels, however we get there, and as quickly as get there in supporting that lower time around or time and range or chronic being exposed chronically to LDL levels, especially in this population who hasn't developed an event, and you're really changing the trajectory. And I think that was, very nice to see in this study, both the larger one and then obviously supporting it from the subgroup analyses. So I think it provides great context to offer that to patients, or say, here's what we know. If we do this in your population before you've had an event, and knowing that you're high risk, we need to really keep trucking along down that. And I think, Kyle, to contextualize, we're not going to go fully in depth in the trial, but there was another trial called Easy Pave that was presented, and kind of briefly want to explain what they presented and what their results find, because I think it supports this and the guidelines as a whole, right? So.
Yeah, so we won't go super in depth on this one, but Easy Pave, which was also released at ACC 26. So this was looking at intensive LDL-C targeting in ASCVD patients. So open label superiority around trial around 3,000 patients that was done in South Korea. And you had two arms looking at patients that got an LDL-C less than 55, or which was like the intensive group, or the conventional group, which is an LDL-C less than 70. And then your primary endpoint was just composite of death from CV causes, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, any revascularization or hospitalization for unstable angina at 3 years. And what they saw was at the 3-year mark, the cumulative incidence of primary endpoint events was 6.6% in the intensive LDL-C group versus 9.7% in the conventional targeting group. One thing just to note really quick about this trial. So it was interesting that 39% of the patients in the intensive group did not reach their target LDL-C, but they still had that benefit. So it just goes back to show, kind of like what we had just talked about, and it's like saying the lower is better, and we really want to try to drive down your LDL-C to less than 55, especially in patients that have ASCVD, and that's what this trial
Yeah,
Easy
because this
Pave.
was a true secondary prevention trial, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so, an argument of the, and not maybe an argument, but Versalius had really some secondary for prevention patients too, because they may have developed atherosclerotics, they just didn't have an event yet.
Correct.
But again, I think it just continues collectively to support that lower is better, this whole inflammation hypothesis, and trying to reduce, and what the guidelines share, this chronic exposure to LDL. Whether it be primary or secondary prevention, we just know that we need to manage this process and get it underway. So I think that that's the messaging there. And then the last trial we're going to talk about, and this is also kind of an additional analysis from the oral PCSK9 inhibitor study. And if you want to jump into that, and we can go from there.
Yeah, so this was a study that kind of made me very, or I was very interested to see the results from this. So this was the oral PCSK9 inhibitor enlicitide versus oral non-statin therapies. So I believe the name was Coral Reef. And the objective was to see the efficacy of enlicitide, a novel oral PCSK9 inhibitor versus the oral other oral non-statin therapies. It was a phase 3 randomized double-blind comparative trial from July 2024 to March 2025. To be included into this trial, you had to be statin treated adults 18 years of age or older with an LDL-C greater than 55 and a previous major ASCVD event, or you can have an LDL-C greater than 70 if an intermediate to high risk for a first event. And exclusion criteria, diagnosis of homozygous or double heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia, uncontrolled diabetes, which was defined as an A1C greater than 9, major ASCVD event within 3 months before screening, planned arterial revascularization within 8 weeks after randomization, severe renal insufficiency, which was deemed eGFR less than 30 or being on dialysis, if you had any hepatic disease, liver test abnormalities, fasting triglycerides greater than 400, histories of tendon rupture, gout, or if you were recently treated with an injectable PCSK9. So you're randomized in this. There was four groups in this trial. So you were randomized in a 2-to-1 to 1-to-2 fashion. So the first group was 20 milligrams of enlicitide, which had about 100 patients. The next group was 180 milligrams of bempedoic acid, which had about 50 patients. The third group was 10 milligrams of ezetimibe, which had about 50 patients. And then the fourth group was a combo of bempedoic acid plus ezetimibe, which had about 100 patients. And everyone took this once daily for 56 days. The primary endpoint of Coral Reef was mean percentage change in LDL-C from baseline to day 56, and then their secondary endpoints included changes in ApoB, non-HDL-C, and also safety events. Baseline characteristics, mean age was about 64, 65% of the population was white, 30% of them were from North America or in North America, mean BMI was 30, most had normal kidney function with an eGFR greater than 60 and 90% of the population. 48% of these patients were on a high-intensity statin. The mean LDL-C for the whole population was anywhere between 89 and 93. Mean ApoB was 85, mean Lp(a) was 34, and mean non-HDL-C was 114. So looking at the results, the primary endpoint, which was like really blew my mind from this, especially if you go pull up the trial and look at, I believe it's table two, so you can really like compare on all groups. So baseline LDL-C in enlicitide was 89.9. At day 56, it was 32. Baseline LDL-C in the bempedoic acid arm was 91. At day 56, 83. Baseline LDL-C in the ezetimibe arm was 93. Day 56 was 67. And in the combo group with bempedoic acid, ezetimibe, baseline LDL-C was 92. At day 56 was 56. So enlicitide just blew it out of the water, performed exceptionally well in reducing that LDL-C and being statistically significant. Looking at
Yes.
ApoB, oh, go for it,
No,
sir.
go. No, no, no. Finish. Sorry.
Looking at ApoB, and anyone that knows me, I'm the president of the ApoB fan club over here. So this was something I was very pleased to see. Mean ApoB in the enlicitide group was 85, at day 56, 38. Huge reductions in ApoB numbers in that. Bempedoic acid reduced it from 85 to 78. Ezetimibe 84 to 67, and the combo group of bempedoic acid ezetimibe was 86 to 60. And then one other cholesterol metric, I won't go through all of them, but the other one I think is important just because Lp(a) is a lot of garnering a lot of attention, especially in our primary prevention space. They looked at Lp(a) levels, mean 35 in the enlicitide at day 56 was 15. Bempedoic acid actually raised Lp(a) levels from 31 to 45. Ezetimibe lowered it slightly from 32 to 28, and the bempedoic acid plus ezetimibe arm raised it from 34 to 46. So enlicitide also did some reductions in Lp(a), which was very positive to see as well. So just overall, a very positive trial. The safety events or discontinued adverse events were very minimal. Compared and not significant at all between each group. So enlicitide is offers an effective treatment option for patients who need additional LDL-C reduction on top of your statin therapy. So I think that's, I think, I don't know what you think, Craig, on this, but those numbers reduction, especially in our non-LDL-C cholesterol metrics, were very eye-opening and very pleasantly surprising to see.
Yeah, no, I mean they fit in line with, the oral agents work just as great. The small molecule has the injectables. I think it'll give people an option, because there are people who don't want to take injectables, right? Or, have different means. So I think it just expands the field for us. But it's nice to see it compared to some of the other secondary agents or non-statin agents, what this looks like and how it could potentially be used or patients for those that are intolerant. And it definitely echoes the trial that was presented at AHA to provide this. So I think we're teeing ourselves up nicely to have soon to have, an oral PCSK9 inhibitor, right? And there are clearly other agents on the market as well that are being developed for to continue to look at the PCSK9. And then to your point, as we talk about these other secondary lipid particles, Lp(a), ApoB, having agents that are clearly working towards them, especially as those are outlined in the new set of guidelines to be kind of monitored and assessed and managed, that gives us ability to be able to do that from that standpoint. So I think it's an exciting time for lipid management.
I agree
So,
100%.
yep. So that's the most of the trials that we're going to talk about today. So I think Kyle taking the time to prepare and have a discussion with us. Kyle, any new things that you've been reading or watching since the last time you've been here?
Not new, but on the side of my eye right here, those I'm a big Texas just sports
Yes.
fan. So our University of Texas baseball team, we just hit a
Baseball team.
walk-off. on extra innings right now, so I was trying not to scream while I was on here.
Yeah, loud
But
and on the podcast, but we would have been like, no, that's good. So, Kyle, I appreciate your time being here and thank you for joining us. And, you know, if you want to find Kyle, you can find him on LinkedIn, and you can, I think that's his preferred means, but please check him out. Thank you for joining, Kyle, and we hope to talk to you again soon. And everybody
Thank you,
else,
Greg.
thank you again for joining us. If you can like or subscribe or send us feedback, we look forward to this. And the next episode will be 2 weeks after this. So thank you all for your time and engagement. Have a good one. Bye-bye.